All right, Rich Al 2008 again. It's great to be here. And hey, nice to see you again. Introduce yourself for those who don't remember you.
I'm Glenn Vanderberg. I work for Relevance. We're an agile consultancy located in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And recently we've been mostly doing Ruby and Rails work. That's what I'm talking about here at Jug.
Excellent. We talked about that in our last conversation last year, although we kind of went around a little bit. And here we have a Niner who also works at Microsoft. People in the audience are going to recognize you from your avatar. Who are you?
My name is Josh Holmes, and my Niner show is actually a codelive.net, and that redirects out to Channel 9 and then the Codelive show under Channel 9. I've been doing that for quite a while. I'm a user experience architect at Microsoft, passionate about all the user experience technologies as well as dynamic languages, which is one of the reasons I wanted to sit down with Glenn today and talk to him about dynamic languages and what the future is of that and where all that's going.
Excellent. Well, let's jump right in here.
Okay. So thank you, Charles, by the way, for doing this.
Absolutely.
So, Glenn, how are you?
Great. How are you, Josh?
Doing real well. You are a large force in the dynamic languages world, and I've seen you do a number of different talks. One of them entitled "The Beauty of Ruby," and that was one of the ground shaking kind of moments in my life when I realized, my programming life, I should say, not my personal life. It's a completely separate thing. but in my programming life was really kind of grokking the beauty of Ruby and dynamic languages. Wanted to sit down and hopefully talk to you about that talk, as well as just dynamic languages in general, and kind of get your feelings around where the industry's headed and that kind of thing.
Sounds great.
So, object-oriented static style languages have been around for quite a while. What do dynamic languages bring to the table?
The important thing that dynamic languages bring is a combination of ease of use. I think they're more inviting and easier to get started. But what I've really come to love is that they make code easier to change over time. And when the people I've worked for and the customers that we have, there's a lot of things we talk about in software about measuring productivity or measuring the quality of code or things like that. But the only metric that really ultimately matters to customers is cost of change over time. And I think that dynamic languages make me more productive in initially delivering systems to our customers. But the most important thing is that they make us more productive later when we have to come back and enhance and build on those systems and add new features. Dave Thomas, Prag Dave, another one of the Ruby guy, the Ruby community guys, calls Ruby the glue that doesn't set, and systems that we build in Ruby stay very flexible even through multiple releases and enhancements and things.
So what is it about the dynamic languages that actually contributes to that? What is it, and actually, before we get to that question, which dynamic languages are you talking about? Are you all dynamic languages, or specifically Ruby, Python? I mean, is there a defined list, or?
Maybe even dynamic languages is the wrong term to use. It's the one we tend to bandy about.
Right.
Right. Stuart Halloway likes to talk in terms of high ceremony and low ceremony languages.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that incorporates the ideas of dynamic typing and an open dynamic system that you can modify at runtime. But it also is large enough to include other things. So, for example, we tend to focus on dynamic typing and not having to specify static type information. But really, the most of the benefit of that comes from the reduced ceremony, the reduced work you have to do. In the talk we just heard, Guy Steele and Dick Gabriel surveyed the history of programming languages, and there was a remark about how looking at early programming languages, how concise and expressive the code is, and there's just a few lines and a lot gets done. And now, by comparison, we look at mainstream programming language code, and there's a whole bunch of stuff which is conversation not between the programmer and the computer, but the programmer and the compiler, and
right.
There's a lot of extra ceremony there. So languages like Erlang and Haskell and Scala are statically typed, but very low ceremony about their static typing because they infer typing information and things like that. When the compiler is figuring that out for you, as in those languages, or when it simply doesn't care, as in Ruby and Python and Smalltalk and the like, there's just less for the programmer to do initially. And then when you want to change what a type means or what types a function works with, the compiler either figures that out or just adapts with you. And it just makes systems easier to manipulate. They're more malleable.
Interesting.
The high ceremony, the type information, turns out to be a lot of infrastructure, I guess, in the bad sense, that couples things together more tightly than they need to be, and you have to go break those couplings or alter their structure before you're allowed to make certain kinds of changes. A good example, possibly the best example of that, is checked exceptions in Java, which sort of percolate through all of your method declarations all the way up the stack, and then when you want to change those or add new ones, you have a lot of change to do throughout your system. Statically typed variables and method parameters and things like that aren't quite that disruptive, but they have the similar kinds of effects.
Right. Yeah. With checked exceptions, the frustration that I always had was that it would not only change the function that you're talking to, but any function that ever wanted to call or reuse that
yes.
function.
That's right.
And then any function that wanted to call or reuse those, it was just yeah. So that's a good example of high ceremony. What are some of the other examples of high ceremony outside of typing and checked exceptions that you see in? Because I do know that you do some Java work, analogous to C# and a lot of other languages. I'm assuming that there's a lot of ceremony there that you're trying to get mm-hmm. away from in the Ruby world.
Right. Interfaces. Variable scope declarations.
Well, let's pick on interfaces for a minute.
Okay.
What's wrong with interfaces?
Interfaces don't really buy the developer themselves very much. When I am programming in Java, I use interfaces, and they're an important part of the language. And I'm not suggesting that a Java programmer should fight Java by avoiding interfaces, because you work with the language you've got. But it was the purpose of interfaces is to sort of separate typing and subtyping from implementation in the language. And in object-oriented languages, we tend to mix those two things up. So we want to share implementation from this class, and so we extend it, and that also establishes a subtyping relationship. But those are two separate things. And there are some languages that treat them as two different things. It might not be obvious to a lot of people, but C++ is a language like that, where you can have public inheritance, which establishes a subtyping relationship, and private inheritance, which there's no visible subtyping relationship there, but you inherit those methods and their implementations. And so the Java designers didn't want to have multiple inheritance for various, mostly good reasons, and so they put interfaces in, and the interface is like a contract of, I will implement these methods and make them work according to the documentation, and so then when you implement an interface, it's a declaration that you're going to do that and support all those methods. But then you have to implement them themselves. And the result of that is a lot of ceremony. You have to specify the variable or the method declarations in the interface and then do it again in the class, and that's unnecessary duplication and extra work and extra maintenance work. If you need to change the interface, then you need to go change all the things that implement it in a similar way. And in more dynamic languages, just to use Ruby for an example, there's a mix-in model where, in addition to classes, there are things called modules. And modules contain not just method declarations, but method definitions, the implementations of those methods as well. And you can include that module into a class. And the effect of that is to, conceptually, it doesn't actually work this way, it's a lot more efficient, but conceptually it just copies all those methods into your class, implementation and all, and you get both things. And because Ruby is dynamically typed, you don't have to have a subtype relationship. That's unnecessary. As long as the methods are there and the behavior is there, you effectively implement that interface, and it's much more low ceremony, and you get those methods, not just their declaration, but their definition in your code right away.
Interesting. So actually, one of the things I heard you say yesterday in the hallway was, again, about interfaces, and you were talking about testing with interfaces, and that one of the recommendations you had was including a test suite with a set of interfaces.
Right.
Because the interfaces define the method, but they don't actually give any clue as to what that method is actually supposed to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so you recommend sending a test suite along with it. And so talk to me about that for a minute.
Oh, this came up. Neil Ford gave a talk in the Rails track here at Jauhu, and some of the participants were asking questions about how sort of fast and loose Ruby is compared to the more static languages.
Yeah, because there are things you can do crazy, like change the base object.
Right, yes. You can do all kinds of crazy stuff, and most of the time you shouldn't.
Right.
but you know, it's nice to be able to when you need to. But some of the participants, some of the audience for his talk had a little bit of problems with this and were asking questions. And one of the particular questions was about mix-in inheritance, that like I just described, including a module into a class, versus interfaces in Java. And they said, well, you know, but there's no guarantee. When you don't have that interface, you're not forced to implement all the right methods. Well, but in Java, you're not forced to implement them correctly either.
Right.
You have to have methods that have the right signature. But then you can implement them to do anything you want. And, of course, that's not a smart thing to do, and that usually indicates a bug. But you can do it. There is no guarantee with interfaces. It provides sort of this illusion of a guarantee that that the class is going to do the right thing. Back when I was doing Java a lot and teaching Java, I used to recommend that if you're on your project, you wrote an interface that other members of your team or users of your API or people who are extending your system or whatever, they were supposed to implement that interface. That you also supply a JUnit test case that any valid implementation of that interface should pass.
That's interesting.
So that you would strengthen that guarantee of, you know, I implement the interface and the compiler says it's okay, and that just means I have the right methods with the right names and signatures. But then I also, my class passes this test case, which indicates that I'm doing sensible things. And just as an exercise, you might try to write a generic test case for an implementation of the Java iterator interface. And you can write one that does sanity checks on that next and has next and remove are doing reasonable things in the context of some collection that you're iterating over. So that said, that would give you the guarantee. And interestingly enough, that test case also guarantees that the right methods are there with the right signature, and so the interface is no longer really necessary except for compile time checking.
Right.
So in Ruby, if you were doing the same thing.
I think I understand that you're saying just the fact that it compiles is not enough to ship it.
Oh, surely not. I'm glad you've noticed that.
That's good. That's good. Yeah.
And yesterday I was talking with Patrick Linsky, and you know we were having the kind of static versus dynamic debate, friendly discussion, and he said, you know, I feel like static typing gives me this whole big group of unit tests that are automatic and I don't have to write. And it absolutely does. The things that static typing catches, the problems that static typing and the compilation and checking process will catch in your code is equivalent to a whole group of unit tests that you don't have to write. They're just automatic and built in. But that's not sufficient. And in my experience working with Ruby, the other unit tests that you have to write anyway to verify that the code is not only structured correctly but behaves correctly also tests all the same things that the static typing tests for you. So it's nice that it's there, but if you have good unit testing discipline, which every programmer should have, you get that anyway. So I really haven't, I have been surprised. I used to be a Java bigot, and I used to actually be kind of a static typing aficionado and really think that was important. But to my surprise, as I've moved into doing Ruby work, I just haven't missed it. And I haven't seen problematic situations where, boy, the compiler would have saved me from that if only I'd had static typing. I just haven't run into that at all.
I'm imagining here the compiler running around with a cape on.
Yeah.
Saving cape.
That's right.
So along the same topics, though, with the testing, one of the fundamental bit flips for me with unit tests was that I realized I was not testing my code. I was designing my code, and I happened to get tests out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you've talked about that, and you actually have alluded to that today with the interfaces. You're helping the interface implementers design their code and figure out what code to write there. So is that as important as I think it is?
It is important. For a while, it was kind of a fad among agile technologists to say testing is not a quality technique; it's a design technique. And I always thought that was getting a bit silly because obviously it is a quality technique as well.
Right.
But they did have a point because we don't have to remind ourselves that it's about finding bugs because that's so obvious. But sometimes we do have to remind ourselves that test-driven development in particular is just as much a design tool as it is a quality tool. And you really do find yourself designing much better code, I think, when you do it in a test-driven way, or even when you write tests immediately after writing the code. Just making the code testable makes it better designed. And design is hard. Even, you know, really experienced programmers think design is hard. And so we shouldn't turn away, you know, anything that really helps us build better design systems, especially if it's low cost and has other benefits, finding bugs and making the systems more robust. So, test-driven development is a huge, huge win.
Yeah,
just across the board.
Now, the question, though, getting back to the dynamic languages in particular, what testing is obviously very important in that world. Would the dynamic languages be successful without it? And what's the relationship there?
Would dynamic languages be successful without good testing practices?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking?
Yes. So I guess fundamentally, I'm asking the person that goes out and starts trying Ruby, trying Python, etc. What should they learn first? Should they learn the language, or should they learn good testing techniques, or should they try to figure out the two of those together?
They should try to figure out the two of those together. When Mike Clark was learning Ruby several years ago. The way he did it was to learn just enough Ruby testing framework foo to be able to write tests that expressed what he thought he learned from reading the book about Ruby. And so he built a test suite that expressed how he understood these things to work. And along the way, and we've all had this experience, the book explains this facility, and if you do this, this happens. If you do that, the other thing happens. And you're going, but there's a third option. What if you do this? And they don't explain that. And, well, okay, I'll just do unit testing and see what happens.
Right.
And then as he was growing more proficient with Ruby, he had that set of test cases to refer to as a quick reference of how things were supposed to work. And it became even more valuable because pretty soon a new version of Ruby came out and some stuff changed, and he was able to quickly find out what assumptions needed to be revised just by rerunning that test suite against the new version of Ruby. It's kind of remarkable. We're seeing this flowering of programming languages right now, and a whole bunch of new programming languages appearing on the scene, and almost every one of them, the first thing that gets written for them is a test suite, yep. Or one of the first things. And it's not usually by the designers of the language. They're not the ones who write the test suite. It's the first programmers who start playing with the language. I think, well, you know, can't do anything decent without a test suite, so that needs to be the first thing we build.
Yep. So I was actually very fortunate and took a programming class, a Ruby class from Joe O'Brien, and he referred to that method of learning Ruby. So I still have a folder that I copy onto every one of my machines called Joe's Class. And in Joe's Class, I keep adding to my set of test suites for the Ruby language.
Right. But I want to go back to your question about can dynamic languages be successful without good testing practices. I think really the more interesting question is, can languages be successful without good testing practices? And I don't think they can in the long run, whether they're static or dynamic. You know, there are, as a Ruby guy, I occasionally encounter naysayers who, you know, boy, it's just so, there's so many loopholes and so many ways to make mistakes, and there's nothing to catch you. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's right, except, boy, I sure did see a lot of Tomcat stack traces in, you know, using Java programs over the years, and they're not actually all that robust if they're not well tested either.
Right.
And programs are buggy all over the place, and we just have to. Neil Ford said something that I just really like, and keep telling everybody I meet that. We've talked for years about trying to bring some kind of engineering rigor to software development and really turn it into software engineering. And at least given what we understand today about software development, we may come up with something better in the future, but today, testing is engineering rigor for software development. And if you don't have good testing practices, don't call yourself a software engineer, because you're not.
Well, if I could ask a question. There are other languages that are interesting, like Eiffel, for example,
oh, sure,
Spec
yes.
Sharp, where you have specifications built into the language, which essentially are test suites, you know, if you will.
Sort of.
I mean,
yeah.
But it does help you ensure that if this doesn't happen, right, then here's what I'm going to do in response, etc. It's an interesting
right.
thing. What are your thoughts on like a dynamically typed language with built-in specifications?
That's a great question. I'm not familiar with Spec Sharp. I assume it's an Eiffel-style designed by contract kind of
exactly.
thing.
Exactly, designed by contract. C-sharp syntax. It's an implementation of C-sharp.
Okay.
Yeah, they actually split off the C-sharp 2 code base
right.
and started adding in the designed by contract stuff.
Oh, okay, nice. So, I've actually encountered this question before, and for a while it really It's like, well, it's not quite the same thing, but I can't put my finger on why. But here's why. That's incredibly useful stuff, and design by contract is a great technique. But a contract or a specification is not the same as tests. And here's why. A contract has to work for all possible inputs into a method or function or something like that. And so it has to be very general. Mm. It's very hard to provide an executable specification for a piece of functionality that is concise and thorough and applies for all possible inputs. In fact, it's just exactly as hard to provide that specification as it is to write the implementation of the method, because what it really is an alternate style of implementation of the method. As a result, contracts in systems that are built that way, contracts tend to be not quite so thorough. They're sanity checks. They guarantee that the inputs are sane and that the result is sane, but not necessarily correct in all of its aspects. In unit tests, you have the freedom to build as many as you want, because in the contract, you don't want to make them too large, because it kind of obscures and drowns out the meat of the implementation. In tests, you can write as many as you want and throw all kinds of weird sample data at it and have different scenarios and test anecdotally, but more thoroughly that way. So they fill different roles. But it's a great question, and not very many people understand the real relationship between those things.
So the design by contract is not a bad thing in your opinion,
No.
It's not the thoroughness that we can get with unit tests, and
no,
it's not.
Not
the executable, what does it actually do, that we can get with unit tests.
It,
just summarizing that.
Contracts, we had talked earlier about, you know, static typing and the compiler's analysis give you this some guarantees.
Right.
That your code is correct in some ways, but not everything. And using design by contract, you can strengthen those guarantees and allow the compiler to check more and more aspects of what you're doing. However, if you want to take that all the way up to the level of those contracts verifying that your code is completely correct, then the contracts are going to be just as hard to write and just as complicated as the code you're testing, and therefore just as likely to have bugs as the code you're testing. And tests can be much simpler.
Yep. That makes sense. Well, Glenn, I have really enjoyed this interview. And
I have too.
This time here. And thank you, Charles, for,
sure.
For allowing us
thank
to
you.
Hijack the Niner.
Oh, not at all. You're a Niner, man. Come on.
So anyways, how can we find out more about you and Relevance Computing and so on and so forth?
Our website is thinkrelevance.com. All one word there, thinkrelevance.com. And it talks about what we do. We do consulting services, software development services, security and architecture evaluations and audits, and agile training as well.
So. Okay, fantastic. And do you have a blog out there?
I do. It's
that's a don't worry about it.
I have the same kind of blog a lot of people do these days, which is not very often updated. But my blog is at vanderburg.org, vanderburg.org.
Thank you so much for spending the time.
Thanks.